Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. It seems appropriate to describe today's two-guest lineup as divinely ordained, given the prominence of the uses and misuses of religion in the show's content. We'll hear from two historians. Christian Dumais will talk about the theology of the Christian nationalists in and around the Trump administration, and Jennifer Mittelstadt will talk about the deep roots of the foreign policy outlook of that same regime. I'm not saying Trump himself, because who knows what his philosophy of life is, aside from maximizing his own power and presence. On the morning of Trump's inauguration, he and some of his retinue were forced to listen to a sermon by the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, Marion Budde. It centered on the need for compassion, empathy, and humility. Though that seems quite consistent with the general tenor of the Christian tradition, Trump was annoyed because he took it as a personal insult, and would-be theologians like J.D. Vance cited Catholic doctrine, notably Ordo Amoris, the Order of Charity, a concept associated with St. Thomas Aquinas. For Vance, it was a theological justification for nativism and xenophobia. One Republican member of Congress said Budde should be deported, and another introduced a resolution condemning her. That got me curious about the theology behind MAGA. So we're joined by the perfect person to elucidate that, Christian Dumais, a professor of history at Calvin University. She was on this show in December 2020 to discuss her book Jesus and John Wayne, a study of the Christian right's creation of a badass Jesus, throwing over all that peace-love stuff in favor of a military hardness. Christian Dumais. To many, Bishop Marion Edgar Budde's message was very much in line with what we think of as Christ's teachings, sympathy for and support of the weak and the marginalized, but also her message about the contempt and outrage that fills so much of our political discourse seemed very relevant, but that is the MAGA brand, essentially. So why did the right precisely find her remarks so outrageous, not just politically, but religiously? What is the theology behind their reaction?
There's a lot behind that reaction. I think one thing that's really important to realize is that the MAGA Christians really build their movement around this us versus them worldview. They represent God and all that is good. And anybody who is against them is against God, against Christianity, against truth. So it's actually Christians like Bishop Budde who disrupt that narrative very powerfully. And that's why you'll often see that in Christian nationalist spaces, many of their targets are fellow Christians themselves who present a different vision of Christianity, not one that divides us against them, but one that says, no, Jesus actually said you have to love your neighbor and even love your enemies. And a Christianity that centers humility, the sense that, you know, we think that this is what God is calling us to do, but each and every one of us is affected by sin. Each and every one of us gets things wrong. And so there's a humility that comes from that. And if you actually listened to the bishop's entire sermon, that was a dominant theme, that she was presenting one vision of Christianity, but always with the sense that, I might not have all the answers here. And to proceed with humility, which is a very different presentation of what Christianity has to do with politics compared to Christian nationalism, which really says we know exactly what God wants and we're going to seize the power to do it.
Doesn't that sound like hubris? Aren't you supposed to be afraid of God and constantly concerned about your own virtues and how you're living your life?
You know, one could certainly argue that, and there is a long tradition within Christian theology, which does. But what we see in Christian nationalism is, and this has been building for decades now, the sense that, again, the world is divided between good and evil. And the evil is out there. So not inside each of us, or not certainly not within, you know, their churches or their religious communities. The evil is, you can kind of fill in the blank. At one point, it was the godless communists, and then it was secular humanists and feminists and liberals and radical Islam, and then all Democrats and the woke, right? There's always an enemy, an outsider that is an imminent threat. Because of that threat, Christians need to be aggressive, kind of this preemptive war strategy. You need to destroy them before they destroy us. This rhetoric has been permeating conservative Christian popular culture for generations now. And so they come by it honestly.
For the full history, I would urge people to read your book, but this does have a long history. This just didn't come out of nowhere.
Right. I mean, you can go back to the 1960s and 70s with the rise of the Christian right, but you can actually go back earlier than that. And the 1930s is actually a critical decade here. And that's when we saw conservative religious groups allying with powerful representatives of corporate America. And they both identified a common enemy, and that was progressive Christianity or social gospel Christianity. So the conservative evangelicals and other conservative Christians thought that mainliners or progressive Christians were too liberal in their theology. And big business thought that their teachings of the social gospel of loving your neighbor and of caring for the least of these interfered with corporate profits. And so this partnership developed in the 1930s, and we're still living with that alliance today and in the reality that they've created. So demonizing social gospel Christianity has a long, long history.
How did we get from Jonathan Edwards and Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God to this kind of American Protestantism?
Oh, man, it is a long and tangled tale. You can look at the populist revivalism that Edwards helped spark and defend. And when we look to the 19th century in particular, that kind of spreads like wildfire across the country. The idea that every believer has power to interpret the scriptures, of course, they still have their own authority structures and their own rules of how to interpret the scriptures, even though they would say, oh, it's just the plain reading of the scriptures. You can trace this history through the 20th century with the rise of fundamentalism. And then in the post-war era, the rise of what we now call evangelicalism, which they initially called neo-evangelicalism. And for a while, historians like to say evangelicals were not fundamentalists. They were much more kind of forward-looking and ecumenical. In fact, fundamentalism has always infused the movement that we call evangelicalism. And we can see that in the formation of the Christian right. And we can see that today when you look at white evangelical voting patterns and their views on things like Christian nationalism and whether Christians and a particular type of Christians just like them ought to be in charge of this country.
Could you define those terms, the fundamentalism and evangelicalism?
Yes. There are long battles
in terms
of how to precisely define these. So fundamentalists, think of in the early 20th century, anti-evolution was one of their key battles, anti-science, the virgin birth and the kind of authority of the scriptures are some of their key issues. One historian has called a fundamentalist essentially, you know, an evangelical who's really angry about something. So a very combative posture. That kind of tone is important because when evangelicals arose in the mid-century, people like Billy Graham, they actually retained a lot of that fundamentalist theology, but had a more friendly outward posture and were able to convert millions of people into this movement as a forward-looking movement rather than a backward movement. But again, the politics really were not that far apart, particularly by the 1960s, when you see some unity around the backlash against the civil rights movement. And then certainly by the 1970s with family values politics, there's not a lot of difference between fundamentalists and conservative white evangelicals as far as how they understand what this country should look like.
Now, you wrote about Franklin Graham's sermon at the inauguration as anti-buddy. What would you characterize as the elements of the Graham theology and worldview?
Oh, Franklin Graham. Yes. He is extremely partisan. He has been a proponent of Trump for many years now. And he is a really great example of one of these MAGA evangelical leaders who absolutely conflates Christianity and with MAGA politics and with the Trump agenda and uses Christianity and in some cases trades on his father's name to baptize the MAGA movement and to rally conservative Christians to that side. He has long had a very prominent position in the evangelical world, both in terms of Samaritan's Purse, this charity that he runs, but also on Facebook. And so he has a massive reach and is able to take the old school evangelicalism, the Billy Graham brand, and then link it up with an aggressive MAGA agenda.
Samaritan's Purse, that makes me think of the parable of the Good Samaritan. But there are just so many things, very famous words and stories attributed to Jesus that are so at odds with this worldview. The Good Samaritan, for example. Let him without sin cast the first stone. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Like, there's just so much that in the scripture, for people who supposedly revere scripture, that is at odds with this worldview. Do they not think it important to reconcile these contradictions? Do they not pay attention to them? How do they deal with that?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And all of those examples are right, and we can add more to them because
driving the money changers out of the temple.
There you go. Or, you know, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel through the eye of a needle, right? We can go on and on here. You're right. These are people who self-identify as, and I quote, Bible-believing Christians, right? The authority of the scriptures, the plain reading of the scriptures, the literal word of God, and then take any of these passages that you've listed, and all of a sudden you get these elaborate explanations about how they don't actually mean what you think they mean. They don't actually mean what they straight up say. And so the parable of the Good Samaritan, what you started off with there. In the Bible, most interpreters throughout Christian history have framed that parable in terms of who is my neighbor? That is the question. And the Samaritan is the people that the Jews did not like. They were the enemy. They were the outsider. And yet in the parable, it is the Samaritan who comes through and shows love at great cost to himself to this person who has been left for dead along the side of the road. Interestingly, that has been getting a lot of airtime these days because you see a whole bunch of Christian nationalist pastors and quote-unquote theologians out there arguing on Twitter right now that no, that's not how to interpret this, not at all. And somehow they're able to twist it to say, no, you're only supposed to love those or most love those very close to yourself. And so you're supposed to love your own family. You're supposed to love your own citizens, not quote unquote illegals. They completely destroy the love your neighbor as yourself in an expansive way, destroy any sense of a common good or any sense of justice, and instead turn it into a defense of tribalism.
Yeah, this is like rank order of the people you're supposed to love.
Yes.
And, you know, it starts with those closest to you, which
our own vice president, right, is promoting that view loud and clear right now.
Yeah, I was going to bring this up. I know this is off your beat somewhat. He's coming from his Catholic point of view and finding old theologians who allegedly support his worldview. The phrase they have from Augustine, the ladder of love, I think it is. What is the role of the Catholic right in this crowd? A lot of the current American right seems to have a very Catholic streak. You see a lot of younger conservatives converting to Catholicism. Much of the Supreme Court is Catholic.
Yes.
A whole lot of the intellectual right these days is Catholic.
Yes.
Why? How do you read that?
You know, this is something that conservative evangelicals have asked for a long time. Historically, if you go back to the 1960s, there was actually quite a bit of animosity, certainly on the side of evangelicals towards Catholics. They were not seen as partners. They were seen as apostates, essentially as getting Christianity wrong. And that really starts to change largely through political alliances. And so initially, it's kind of a top-down thing that in the Christian right, you see conservative Catholics working together with conservative evangelicals, and the issue of abortion is really key here. So by the end of the 1970s, the opposition to abortion really brings these factions together. And over time, that anti-Catholic bias begins to recede. What the Catholics bring to the table here is a stronger intellectual tradition. Evangelicals aren't really known for robust intellectual life. Catholics bring a much longer tradition, and particularly the tradition of natural law, which then kind of roots their understanding of society, of human relationships, of sexuality, and not just in interpretation of the scriptures, but in natural law. That provides a kind of ballast that conservative evangelicals have found really helpful in pressing forward their kind of mutual understanding of what Christian society should look like with respect to sexuality, with respect to issues like abortion. Anything can be kind of rooted in this natural order, depending who gets the right to interpret exactly what that is. And so that natural law tradition is becoming more and more popular in Protestant circles these days. I'm seeing a lot of talk of kind of recovering a quote-unquote Protestant natural law tradition, borrowing heavily from the Catholic tradition.
Yeah, and there's this integralism that people like Adrian Vermeule and these, you know, Catholic right-wingers, a theological state, essentially. How does that sit with the evangelicals?
That's where, on a popular level, most would not be familiar with that. But it, then again, in the upper echelons, behind closed doors politically, that's where you're going to find some common cause there. Within Protestant Christian nationalist spaces, I think there still is a variety of understandings of what exactly a Christian state should look like. Some of them closer to an integralist vision. There's still some variety there. One of the things that I'm curious about is now that we have a number of self-proclaimed Christian nationalists in positions of power and more likely to be approved shortly, right, with Russell Vogt likely to be installed in a very powerful position, the Office of Management and Budget. He's also one of the primary authors of Project 2025 and the author of the chapter on executive power. We're going to see now what a Christian nationalist state looks like and how much disagreement there is among various Christian nationalist strands now that they actually have the power to implement some of this strategy.
I'm speaking with the historian Kristen Dumais. Project 2025, I read some chapters of that. And for example, the one on the Department of Labor starts talking about God and the family. And, you know, yes. The theology is throughout that document.
Yes.
And I don't think people really appreciate just how theological it is. So could you bring that out for us and make that clear to people who may not be familiar with it?
Oh, the document itself, you know, the project is around 900 pages. So it's a pretty hefty document, but you're right, the theology runs through and through. The key point to understand about Christian nationalism in Project 2025, which again is essentially the blueprint for this Trump administration, is the idea that the liberty guaranteed in our Constitution is the liberty to do what you ought to do, not what you want to do. Now, who determines what you ought to do, right? This is where we can pull out, you know, their understanding of the Bible and their understanding of natural law. And in Christian nationalist circles, the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation is the bedrock. And what some Christian nationalists mean by that is that our founding documents were in fact inspired by God, that our founders were Christians in the same way that they are Christians. So they're essentially kind of reading back their contemporary conservative Christian theology back on the founders. Therefore, they can claim that the Constitution itself reflects God's order and God's law. So any interpretation of the Constitution, any application of the Constitution cannot contradict God's law as they interpret it. That is really key to understanding the whole document. And they do not respect rights granted in the Constitution if those rights appear to contradict their understanding of God's law.
That's just not factually correct about the founding fathers. I mean, another thing, how do they deal with that?
It is not. And this has been a frustration for historians for decades now. And this is what you have to know. This is not something new. Evangelicals, like, they have this vast publishing industry. I wrote about that some in Jesus and John Wayne. And this is largely invisible to people outside these spaces. But we're talking about books that sell millions of copies, right, regularly. And one of the popular authors inside that world is a man by the name of David Barton, founder of Wall Builders Organization. And for decades now, he has been trading in these myths about a Christian nation, about Christian America, spreading verifiably false stories about the founding, about the Constitution, says the separation of church and state is a myth. in Christian history spaces, right, we've been kind of battling this for generations now and trying to debunk, and in fact, debunking his own Christian publisher withdrew one of his books because it was so full of lies. But that doesn't seem to matter. The propaganda sticks. You should know that the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has been steeped in these teachings. Yes, they are based on myth. They are factually disprovable, and that does not seem to matter.
Girls Gone Bible, you have a clip on your Substack of their performance at the inauguration. I was unaware. They were really quite stunning to watch. that giggly devotion to Trump was shocking. I mean, is this some ideal of femininity that they represent? But then on top of that, choosing Trump as God's vessel is just so weird. I mean, this crude, violent liar as God's vessel to a civilian seems quite odd. So what's the theology behind that?
Yeah, that is actually really important. And while it certainly looks kind of cringy, it's not at all fringe. So these two women are coming out of the charismatic tradition, roots in Pentecostal, spirit-filled Christianity. But this charismatic tradition has been turning increasingly political in the last 50 years or so. It's connected now or has given birth to this movement known as the New Apostolic Reformation. And these folks are drawing on spirit-filled theology, but have long been, I mean, since 2016, proclaiming Trump as God's anointed one, as God's vessel. They claim to receive direct prophecies from God. Seems a little bit wild, but, this is a very, very popular movement with millions of adherents, not just in this country, but around the globe. And these are the folks who were around Trump in his first administration. Those Christian advisors, the vast majority of them were coming out of this charismatic tradition. They have been receiving prophecies from God for years now. So back in 2016, the idea was that Trump was the King Cyrus. King Cyrus in the Bible was not one of God's people, but he was a pagan ruler that God sent to free God's people. And so Trump could be seen in that respect. He didn't have to be a Christian himself to be God's anointed one to save God's people, conservative white Christians, at this perilous moment in our own history. Now, this last time around, things got a little darker. The prophecies that now were pointing to Trump as Jehu, another Old Testament figure, but one with a more violent backstory. And Jehu purged Ahab and Jezebel, enemies of God's people, had Jezebel thrown out of the window. Her body was eaten by dogs. And then he drained the swamp and had all of the officials who had worked with Ahab and Jezebel in their administration put to death. That's the prophecy that we're working with now. And again, for people outside this tradition, it all seems pretty wild. It is very powerful in shaping the views of millions of Americans. It's worth noting, too, that the Christian imagery that you saw on January 6th, largely the result of people from this tradition showing up there, taking buses, their leaders, calling them to go to the Capitol to pray for, you know, God's miraculous work to be done.
The gendering of this, I mean, the gendering is very important. The Girls Gone Bible, their whole presentation is really girly.
It is.
And they're celebrating this cartoonish masculine figure of Trump.
Yes.
This really is very important to their doctrine, right?
That's exactly right. The way gender works inside these spaces is absolutely a celebration of gender difference. The strong man, that God made men to be aggressive, filled them with testosterone to protect faith, family, and nation. So it's this militant conception of masculinity and masculinity as protection and protecting vulnerable women and children. The flip side is this ideal of femininity, a hyper-feminine model of women who need to look to the strong man for protection, who are presenting some sort of vulnerability, but also what messes with people who just look in from the outside Sexual allure is also part of this, that a woman's job is to submit to her husband's authority and also to meet his sexual needs and to seduce him sexually. And this is understood to be within the bounds of heterosexual marriage is the ideal. And that is the foundation of our society, you know, heterosexual families headed by the patriarchal authority, women who serve them, who support them, and who essentially, you know, seduce them in this relationship. This is how God ordained the family to be, and this is how God ordained society. So you see this kind of embrace of a particular style of femininity throughout these spaces. You see it through the Republican Party as well, like various presentations of this. Once you're kind of looking for it, you're going to see it everywhere, often hypersexualized, hyper-femininity.
So this is key to why trans issues are so radioactive for these folks.
Yes. LGBTQ issues generally, and then particularly issues around trans rights, really go to the heart of this kind of essential component of their worldview, of their understanding of the very foundations of society, and that is gender difference. Boys will be boys, right? Girls are the opposite of boys. They root that in their interpretations of the scriptures. God created male and female, and they'll have some verses where they interpret God's will is that women submit to their husbands and that men are to have authority. Now, it's worth noting that throughout Christian history, there have in fact been many interpretations of what faithful masculinity looks like and what faithful femininity looks like. There is a long tradition of Christian feminism going back centuries. There is a long tradition of visions of masculinity that challenge this militant and aggressive version, one based more on the life of Christ, based more on these teachings that we were mentioning earlier about loving your neighbor. And when Jesus tells Peter, put your sword away. And when Jesus tells all of his followers to be servants. There are theological differences at the heart here. And inside Christian spaces, these debates are raging. And it's in the interest of those with power to quash those debates and present, no, there is only one way to be a Christian man, to be a Christian woman, to be a Christian.
Finally, you write about Pete Hegseth as an archetype of the Christian nationalist figure. How does he exemplify this doctrine? How is Pete Hegseth the walking incarnation of Christian nationalism?
The more I learned about Pete Hegseth, the more I felt that he could have been a through line through my book, Jesus and John Wayne. He, the military heroism, the anti-Islam that runs through this kind of Christian nationalist tradition, Islamophobia even, and the militancy justified to protect and preserve Christian civilization. But also in this kind of aggressive masculinity, we know that he has a history of allegations of abuse. In my book, where I study this Christian masculinity as it has become intertwined with militarism within evangelicalism, I have an entire chapter of how this leads to abuse of women, of children, and how it leads to communities covering up that abuse over and over again. And so it was really uncanny to kind of see him come forward. It's also worth noting that Pete Hegseth is a member of a CREC church, which is in the denomination of Doug Wilson. Doug Wilson is one of the kind of leading characters in my book, Jesus and John Wayne, somebody a lot of people hadn't heard about, who has been essentially trying to build a Christian nationalist enclave in Moscow, Idaho, for decades now. And there's always this debate, oh, he's a really fringe guy, right? In fact, what we're seeing over the last few years is figures like Doug Wilson moving more and more into the center. So you've got somebody like Doug Wilson coming from one side. You've got these charismatic folks in the New Apostolic Reformation coming from another place. You've got right-wing Catholics coming in, and they're all uniting around some of these core values, promoting this idea of a Christian nation. And these are the folks who are now in power or have very close access to those in power in this Trump administration.
That was Kristen Dumay, professor of history at Calvin University and author of Jesus and John Wayne, published by Liveright. My name is Doug Henwin, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Daddy was a cowboy, hard as a rock. Mama, she was quiet as a prayer. that he'd always tell me, "Son, you gotta be tough." Mama kissed my cheek and say, "Play fair." I did my best to make him proud of me, but it's never been an easy place to be. Somewhere between Jesus and John Wayne, a cowboy and a saint, crossing the open range. I try to be more like you, Lord, but most days I know I ain't. I'm somewhere between Jesus and John Wayne.
Some of the song that gave Kristen DeMay the title of her book, performed by the Gaither Vocal Band. Next, the thinking behind Trump's foreign policy. Though he and his posse are sometimes described as isolationists, there's nothing isolationist about wanting to annex Canada, Gaza, Greenland, and the Panama Canal. My next guest, Jennifer Mittelstadt, a professor of U.S. history at Rutgers, had a piece in the New York Times a few days ago identifying what she calls a sovereigntist tradition on the American right that goes back over a century. Like Trump and company, the tradition mixes imperialism, nativism, and racism into a single toxic brew. Jennifer Mittelstadt. So, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out what Trump is all about. Intellectuals love to classify things. He may be uncategorizable. But nonetheless, one hand, people call him an isolationist, but in fact, he has tremendous real estate ambitions in this hemisphere. So is isolationist the right term?
No, isolationist is not the right term. I feel confident in saying that in part because I don't think really that isolationist is really a term that most historians who study U.S. foreign policy really except as a term regarding a people who sort of did exist. It once was that, but I think since then, there are a number of scholars who've dived in to the history of purported isolationism and found instead that the question wasn't that people who, for example, famously opposed entrance into World War II and were called isolationists didn't want to engage at all with the world. Rather, it was on what terms they would be engaging with the world. So I don't think that isolationism so accurately describes very many people anyway in U.S. history, and I don't think it describes Trump. So we have to look elsewhere.
When did the term arise? Was it around World War I and the people who didn't want to enter? Is that the locus classicus of this?
I think that I will admit that in some ways, it's my own moniker to call them sovereigntists, although they themselves use the term sovereignty over and over again. I think they probably thought of themselves more as anti-internationalists. Anti-internationalism sort of being the other side of the coin of their understanding of what national and their personal sovereignty was. So yeah, it originates in and around World War I, when I think so many people faced a kind of cataclysm in looking at what was happening in the world. That was just a really dynamic period when globalization that had preceded came to a screeching halt because of the war. There was empires collapsing. There were new states being formed and new nationalist ambitions among people who had not had states and had been the possessions of imperial powers. And kind of everything was up in the air. And then right in the middle of it comes this proposal for what is essentially a kind of suprastate, a kind of League of Nations, thinking about bringing state sovereignties together into one, you know, sovereignty that exists above it. And I think it throws open a lot of questions for people, including the everyday people I'm sort of looking at in my archival search who see that and are quite scared about it.
If we ignore the fact that the country was founded in an act of imperial expansion, we had begun to acquire some colonies at the end of the 19th century. How did these folks think about those?
That's actually a good question, Doug. On the precise question of imperialism, I think there are a range of opinions within the broad tradition that I would call anti-internationalism. I don't think any internationalists had any hesitation about invoking the Monroe Doctrine, and many of them did, and broadly understood the Western Hemisphere to be the kind of rightful sphere of influence and perhaps even intervention for the U.S. There may have been a range of options on like whether to hold the Philippines, for example, for any extended period of time, or what it meant to bring Puerto Rico in. Some were skeptical and some were not. To the degree, though, that they saw internationalism as a dual threat, perhaps both to empire and to nationalism itself, they might find some grounds for being leery of internationalism.
The whole idea of the Monroe Doctrine is certainly not isolationist by any means. How did that reconcile these notions of sovereignty?
One of the things that I do in my work is by, I think, avoiding focusing solely on policy and policymakers, but looking more at the cultural, intellectual, and kind of lived experiences of the people who end up calling themselves sovereignty, you can get a glimpse of their willingness to sort of imagine sovereignty pretty broadly, in fact, to sort of think of the ambit of what a native-born Anglo-Saxon American can understand as their sort of proper domain and territory. That's where, in part, the Monroe Doctrine fits in, as them imagining that the Western Hemisphere needs, in fact, the guardianship of the wisely governed United States. And so they can imagine that it would be important to maintain that control and to keep the corrupt politics of Europe and of any internationalist organization after 1919 out of that realm.
The last third of the 19th century saw immigration from areas that were previously unfamiliar to native-born Americans. What did that influx of more disreputable sorts of Europeans do to their international outlook?
You're putting your finger on one of the driving forces in the creation of an anti-internationalist politics, and that is in the United States, the influx of immigrants. You might think of the people that I'm looking at who are the daughters of the American Revolution and especially their National Defense Committee. I'm looking, for example, at Protestant fundamentalists. I'm looking, for example, at groups that come out of the fight against the League of Nations and reform as the sentinels of the Republic, and a group of constitutional nationalists. If you were to sort of group them, you'll see that there are these Venn diagrams overlapping with other movements that historians have documented. For example, there's a lot of overlap with Protestant fundamentalists who are resistant to modernist theology in the 1920s. There's a lot of overlap also with anti-women suffrage activists. And there's a lot of overlap with nativists. In fact, there the Venn diagrams, I think, almost fully overlap. The people who are resistant to joining the League of Nations, who are in the groups that I look at, are pretty much to a person nativists and in favor of, and in fact, in some cases, architects of the 1921 and 1924 restrictions on immigration.
Yeah, a lot of those disreputable immigrants were socialists and internationalists. So that did that have an effect in their outlook?
That's exactly it. I mean, there is some element of like the worries about whether or not people who are not, in fact, of Anglo-Saxon origin have it in them to sort of participate in and do Anglo-Saxon governance. But I think you've put your finger right on it. It's exactly the fear, particularly after the Bolshevik Revolution, that some of who you're going to get when you have these immigrants come in are radicals. They will espouse not only perhaps socialist or communist beliefs, but also other dangerous beliefs like pacifism or internationalism itself, which is understood as a kind of subversive, anti-nationalistic, wholly unpatriotic, unassimilable ideology.
You note in the interwar period, the sovereigntists of the time championed the growing fascist movements in Europe. What was the appeal of that to them?
Yeah, it was a surprise to me, actually, I have to say, that anti-internationalism grew in the wake of the defeat of the U.S. joining the League of Nations, but indeed it did. And in the 1920s, there's sort of a honing, actually, of the anti-internationalist politics through targeting a lot of the remaining perceived radical thinkers and radical ideas in the United States. And I think what happens in the 1930s is that the coinciding of the New Deal, which is perceived as a slippery slope towards socialism among precisely the internationalists they've been worried about since the 1920s, coincides with world events where, in their mind, these valiant nationalist regimes emerge to fight both communism and socialism on the one hand, but also to thumb their nose at the internationalism of the League of Nations on the other. This sort of all comes together and they find themselves really unsympathetic with the idea of joining with the allied United Nations in a war against regimes that at best they understand as bold, if flawed, nationalist regimes, but at worst among some of them that they really are sympathetic to the extreme fascism among them. They understand what they're doing as standing athwart the impending growth of an internationalized world and the formation of an incipient United Nations when they oppose entrance into World War II on the side of the Allies. And they think of themselves instead as championing a broad anti-globalism, anti-internationalism, anti-cosmopolitanism that is embodied in some of the principles and ideologies of Franco, Nazi Germany, and Italy.
Yeah, and there are certainly like large rallies in support of them in New York City in the 30s.
Oh, sure. Actually, my chapter on the 1930s follows two characters from very different worlds. One who's sort of a constitutional nationalist in the world of businessmen, a man named Merwin Hart, and also the work of a conservative Catholic by the name of the Reverend Edward Lodge Curran. And together, actually, they host rallies in 1938 and 1939 in support of Franco's Spain. These are separate, of course, from like the great rally at Madison Square Garden, though at least Merwin Hart, I believe, does attend that one as well.
What you've been describing, this ideological constellation, sounds a lot like Donald Trump and the MAGA people. And you note that Norman Vincent Peale, the minister who married Trump and his first wife Ivana, was part of this sovereignty movement. Well, how does this constellation fit in with the worldview of Donald Trump then?
Well, I'm not sure it fits in with the worldview of Donald Trump, despite the fact that the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale did marry him. If we put Trump himself and his sort of personal politics aside, because I really don't know, I think most people don't know what his personal political ideology is.
It changed from week to week, yes.
It's right. He's a bit of an impresario in that regard. The people who support him and the people who sort of have led the rise of the right in the last 20 years, they are well aware of sovereigntist politics, perhaps less in the form of the pre-World War II formation, but certainly in the forms of the post-war formation, which is, of course, when the movement really grows and in some ways hones the kinds of ideas that will be more relevant to today's world. Ideas about why the UN is a danger, for example, why NATO is an incipient world government, why it's not important not to be involved in internationalist pacts. Those politics, I think, would be very familiar to and are a kind of genealogy for the people who are influencing Trump from a sovereignty perspective within the current administration.
I'm speaking with the historian Jennifer Mittelstadt. In the 50s and 60s, those were really marginal politics, the John Birch Society, get the UN out of the US and the US out of the UN and all that business. And now it's like very influential in the Republican Party and in the White House. It's a remarkable growth of what was once a pretty strange and marginal worldview.
Well, I think I'm going to contradict you on that there, Doug. I think that what we've found actually among historians who study the right, and I'm thinking here in particular of the work of John Huntington, whose book Far Right Vanguard is really impressive. He documents that more than we have understood, our understanding of these groups as marginal was actually a whitewashing job by the kind of Bill Buckley new conservatives who, in fact, relied upon them as their readers, relied upon them to show up in favor of Barry Goldwater, but then found it inconvenient because of their extremist views and painted a picture of them as a kind of marginal fringe. They were aided in this, of course, by the work of many liberals who called them marginal crackpots, etc. What was happening is that these ideas were laughed at by some in order to portray them as marginal, while inside the new conservative movement and the growing popularity of right-wing ideas, they were fueling the movement. They were both giving it the ideological contours, and they were also manning the barricades, showing up for all the meetings, voting, getting people out, raising awareness, creating a right-wing media sphere. And I actually think that they nurtured these views on the right for a really long time, and they were easily pick-upable by anyone, including people like Phyllis Schlafly, who like really comes to this early on in the 50s, a kind of America first fear of internationalism, and who, of course, finds herself quite at the center of Republican politics by the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
They would have had not much of a place in the Eisenhower or Nixon White Houses, though.
Absolutely not. I mean, those two were enemy number one. They were internationalists and scorned. And I mean, in part, one of the reasons why Robert Welch, leader of the John Birch Society, is driven out of the semi-respectable conservative circles by people like Bill Buckley is, one, the anti-Semitism, but two, the insistence that Eisenhower is, in fact, a plotter in the world government scheme and a communist. that is sort of de rigueur thinking among most people on the right who oppose the UN and are fiercely anti-communist. But by the time he sort of really articulates it about Eisenhower, that's no longer acceptable to say, except for that it is among everybody who's like not the National Review, who goes on saying it. Those people are trounced, you know, really after 1964, even though Barry Goldwater loses, they take over the party.
Panama has been very important among this crowd for decades and decades, right?
Yeah, to my great surprise. I mean, I can't tell you, Doug, for how long I was reading through the archives and I would just skip over the Panama stuff and I would say to myself, ugh, what is this craziness about Panama? Why do they love the Panama Canal? I get the UN stuff. What does this have to do? And until finally, I really started paying attention and I realized that for them, Panama fits into a broad sovereigntist ideology in the ways that we were talking about at the beginning of this phone call, in that it's a kind of celebration of American influence in the Western Hemisphere, the resourcefulness and genius of Americans being able to build the canal in the first place, and to kind of hold on to this position that's essential in the world of global trade. But it's more than that, because after the creation of the UN, what people who are anti-internationalists start to espy among the Panamanians is a crafty working with the new Afro-Asian bloc, is what they call it, the non-European and non-white nations, to sort of position themselves for self-governance and for decolonization. Once Panama starts speaking the language of decolonization about the canal, people in the sovereigntist movement have their antenna up and ready to go. And as early as 1957, are petitioning in Congress to defend the canal and to not cede anything to Panamanians in control. This proves to be incredibly difficult. And in fact, the Eisenhower administration, Kennedy administration, Johnson administration sort of all cede little bits, often symbolic, of quote unquote governance or sovereignty to the Panamanians. And the people who I'm looking at are out on the barricades over this saying, this is the first step through which the United Nations will come in and actually strip the U.S. of its territory. And beware, it has other plans as well. And those involve the Convention on Human Rights, which will come and tell us how we are able to govern our own communities with regard to the treatment of African Americans. So it becomes a really important symbol of the potential losses of sovereignty that are embodied in internationalism.
Trump aside, how deeply rooted is this tendency in the Republican Party? And what is its root in society? I mean, what is the social base for this kind of politics?
The social base for it perhaps is different at different times. And I really can't speak to what the social base is since the 1990s, because my archival work really only goes up to there. So there I would really be speculating. But over time, I think it's groups that would be unsurprising to you. I mean, I think that the people who have real investments in the existing sovereignties of circa 1919 are native-born white men of a conservative political view, often people who own small businesses. They are religious fundamentalists. They are those who are invested in white supremacy and its actual governance and jurisdiction in their local communities. That, I think it's fair to say, continues over time, although it takes different forms. I mean, I wouldn't say that Phyllis Schlafly's Eagles in the 1970s are exactly the same as the Daughters of the American Revolution in the 1920s, or that Protestant fundamentalism is exactly the same in the 1980s as it is in the 1920s, but there are real continuities there. Those people maintain a kind of active world of researching and writing and disseminating information about the dangers of internationalism all throughout this period. And certain events in global politics will spark their interest and they'll sort of pop up and reassert their point of view and at certain times gain the ear of different people. I mean, the Panama Canal is a great example. Reagan ends up taking up the politics, like mainstream Republicans even take up the politics of the Panama Canal.
Yeah, Reagan said, what? We bought it, we paid for it, it's ours.
What's interesting about that is that's not like a politics of the moment. That's straight out of the mouths of what sovereigntists in these obscure groups like the Congress of Freedom, the Federation for Constitutional Government, the Patrick Henry League were saying in the 1950s and 1960s.
Every time I look at history, I get the feeling that there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, is that an occupational hazard of your work?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's also weirdly reassuring, though. And let me take a long route around to saying why that is. For a long time, I really struggled to understand the rise of Trump and, in fact, thought it would never happen. And I'm sad to say I've been working on this project long enough that it was, you know, it was a glimmer in my eye before Trump was a feature on the scene. And I really didn't know what to make of him for a long time. And then when I started to see this discourse of anti-internationalism, when I started to see the key word of sovereignty repeated over and over again, and then when I started to understand that there were people like, for example, Ed Martin, who is now the acting U.S. attorney in the Washington district named by Trump, but who's head also of Phyllis Schlafly's Eagles, there I could sort of start to see the connections because Phyllis Schlafly's Eagles still has their main page on national sovereignty. I started to see the resonances, but when I really was able to trace it all the way back to the pre-World War II period, and particularly to the 1919 period, it helped me think that maybe now, in the past 20 years, is a little bit like the period around 1919. Real questions about what is a state? How does a state exist in this rapidly, insanely globalized world where global capital can go anywhere, where internationalism has really been the only game in town since the end of the Cold War, since the IMF and the World Bank have implemented a kind of the Washington consensus? I think real questions have arisen about whither sovereignty. That history is repeating itself is helpful in that it helps see these recurrent moments of crisis about sovereignty. It's a recurring problem, and we're having it again.
That was Jennifer Mittelstadt, professor of U.S. history at Rutgers. The book she's referring to is not out. She's only wrapping it up now, and given the pace of academic publishing, we probably won't see it for a few years. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Burning Building by Lucy Krueger and the Lost Boys, described by their agent as an art-pop ambient noise band based in Berlin. Till next week, bye.
Oh no, oh no, oh no. Hey girl, let's go.